This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, back on the broom, more enchanting children's fiction.
And we are very, very happy to welcome back James Nicol. Welcome back, James.
Hello.
Hi.
Now, you've been on the show a couple of times with us, and we were debating on whether we'd ever be able to get you back again now that you're a big hotshot author. So we're incredibly pleased. This is actually the first recorded episode we've done this year.
Oh, happy new year. Nice to be back.
So, James, I understand that we have another installment of the Apprentice Witch series coming out relatively soon.
Yes, so A Witch Alone is due for release on the 1st of March, which seems kind of frighteningly close now, having felt like it was years and years and years away. So I think the first print run was done just before Christmas, I believe. I didn't get to go to the printers this time because it's been quite busy. So I'm expecting a finished copy to crash land on the doormat any day now, so I can have a look through and go, no, I spelled that wrong.
How incredibly exciting. And actually, there is the Chicken House have actually put up a small snippet on the website, haven't they?
Yes, first chapter is on the website already.
I was just having a read of that, actually. Got me all excited. I felt all tingly.
Yeah, I read it a few days ago.
Look at Jules. Jules always reads things about...
doing our homework.
I know, it does sound a bit like I was saying, I've already done my homework.
So maybe I'm the type of person who does things just before they're due, and Jules is the type of person... Anyway, so I am just from the impression of reading the first chapter, which is available to all of our listeners. We'll include a link for you guys so that you can go and check it out as well. It's great to be pulled back into the world. Obviously, there's a bit of a scene change because we've moved from Lull and they're back in the city now.
Yes, so it starts off in Kingsport, which actually the Apprentice Witch begins in Kingsport because that's where Ariamwyn comes from.
Yeah.
And that's where she is at the beginning of the book, waiting for her evaluation. Yes. In A Witch Alone, she's gone back to Kingsport for a holiday, a much needed little respite after all of the goings on of the Apprentice Witch. And she's gone to Kingsport with her friend Sally, and they've been having a jolly old time in the city. Sally's been attending auditions to be in a play, and they've been going to, you know, they've been doing city break stuff, going to museums and galleries and hanging about. And the first chapter, as you'll see, is just kind of friends having breakfast and chatting over things and a bit of mulling over what's preceded the events from the Apprentice Witch, and they're getting ready to go to a parade. The king is having a parade in Kingsport, and Sally's desperate to go, and so that's what happens after the first chapter. Is they go to this royal parade, and it's a bit of a disaster, and more than one. It was all of it was really fun to write, but I really enjoyed the chapter that's called Royal Pandemonium.
I love it because Ariamwyn's general life can be Ariamwyn went to do something and it was a bit of a disaster.
Yeah.
And she's not usually because of her.
no, not at all. I mean, she's fairly capable, and she sort of starts out, you know, with this kind of she's now a qualified witch. Spoiler if you haven't read the first book. And she's, you know, she's faced this very great trial over the course of the first book, and succeeded. And so she's feeling fairly confident. And then, you know, one thing and another, it kind of as with all of us, it never really lasts as long as we hope it would, it will, because something will always crop up and kind of say, no, you know, don't get too comfy in this position, because life is coming to get you. And even though she's qualified, she still, you know, she doesn't really feel that much different from when she was wearing her moon brooch instead of her silver star. But she sees that other people around her start to act slightly differently and expect a lot more of her, even though she's done an incredible amount just because she's now a qualified witch. So there's lots of fun and games on the cards. Oh,
that's actually made me think of another question. I've got two questions, so I'm going to be greedy. The first one is, what you're talking about there sounds very much like Ariane when suffering from what writers call imposter syndrome.
Yes.
This is probably a bit of a mean thing to ask you, actually, but would you say that with the success of the first book, her journey sort of paralleling yours a little bit there?
Maybe a little bit, but also when I started to write the second book in my other working life, there was so much going on. I took on some extra responsibility at work, and it was just the worst thing I could have done at that point. It was really silly of me to have agreed to have done a lot of extra work when I had so much other stuff. This was kind of in the build up to The Apprentice Witch coming out. And I really did think I'd taken on far too much at that point and shouldn't have agreed to do it. So I suppose it was more, not necessarily my writing life, but my other life, my working life. It was kind of mirroring that slightly, taking on more than you expect. You say yes to something, you think, oh yeah, that'll be fine, it'll be absolutely fine, and then this happens and then that happens, and you're like, why on earth did I agree to do this? This is just the most stupid thing in the world.
Yeah.
And I've got a book to write and a book to promote and all of this other stuff as well, but and as you know usually happens, you kind of survive and you get through it. But yeah, imposter syndrome, I don't think any writer doesn't ever have imposter syndrome in one way, shape or form. You know, you get it before you're a published author, and you sort of think, oh goodness me, I can't talk to that person because they're a proper published author and I'm just about to be published author. I'm not on that level. And then I think when you are published, you then still, it's always a comparison. You're always sort of looking at other people and thinking, oh goodness me, it's not, you know, I'm not like them, or I don't, you know, I've not done that many events, or I don't talk like that, or I don't send out a regular newsletter, or I haven't been on TV, or, you know, you're always going to be comparing yourself to somebody or other. But hopefully there's some poor wretch out there comparing themselves to you as well. So
yeah, I think that was one of my biggest take homes of last year, actually, is no matter where you are on your writer journey, there is someone a few rungs below you looking up and thinking, oh, I wish I was that successful. Which is a bit of a wake-up call, really. Okay, second question. You were saying, obviously, Ariane Wynne has quite a big task to do in the first book, no spoilers, and, you know, she's become a qualified witch. Did you find that you had any trouble sort of upscaling the danger a bit in the second book so that she'd be out of her depth again?
We certainly went round the houses a bit in terms of the kind of the sort of the highs and lows of the book, I would say. But no, not really. It was always the kind of the main thread of the story, which is a secret mission. I'm not spoiling anything by telling you she's sent on a secret mission. That was always there, the main piece of the plot was that she goes off on this mission to find something that only she can find. But it was actually making that as hard as possible for her to do. I suppose that was where the trials came in. But no, it didn't feel difficult. It just felt like it took a long time. We went through several drafts of A Witch Alone, as you always do. But I think, you know, again, that kind of, oh, I've done it once now, I should know what I'm doing. I think every time you sit down to write, it's going to be slightly different because everything around you is different and the way you feel is different. And it was interesting. And I, in my acknowledgements in the second book, I said, writing a second book is a lot harder than you actually think it's going to be. You know, I don't want to use that kind of overused phrase, but the difficult second book or second album. I don't know whether it feels difficult at the time that you're doing it. It just feels like it's part of the process. But when you then sit back and reflect on it, you think, yeah, do you know what? That was quite something. And I think for me as well, it was a lot quicker than writing the first book, which when I started to write The Apprentice, which I had all the time in the world. And when it was the second book and you've got a deadline, it's very different. And as I said, I stupidly took on more stuff in my other working life as well, and not the brainiest move I've ever made, I don't suppose. But there we go. It's done now, and it was useful fodder for the book.
Now, there's something I wanted to discuss, and we'll sort of expand on this sort of general theme. The beginning of A Witch Alone has a very comforting and very comfortable feel to it. Mm-hmm. You know, you almost feel like you're there with them. This is a sort of a Sunday afternoon. You know, it's coming in toward lunchtime, but they've just had breakfast. They're in their dressing gowns. You know, that you create this beautiful imagery of the breakfast table and the crumbs, and it's, you're there. You're really there. It feels very, very comfortable. I'm not sure. It makes me think of cream tea, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? It's an incredibly lovely image. It's very comfortable. And obviously she's joking with Sally, and there's this really nice rapport. And something that we had in the first book as well was the building up of Ariane Wynne's group of friends. Because she came into Lull very alone, and it seems that her school life was also, she was very alone because she was so she was so bullied by Gemma. So to now start the second book in a completely contrary kind of way, I think that's probably one of the big pulls in. And seeing a character being liked by another character almost makes you want to like them as well. So you feel like you're part of this group of friends, but the book is called A Witch Alone. Now, obviously, I don't want any spoilers, I just want to talk a little bit about actually how Ariane Wynne has more to lose now because of what she's gained from the first book. And seeing this precious and lovely relationship shown right at the start, and knowing Ariane Wynne is in a very comfortable position where she is now, kind of makes me nervous, because I know that you are a cruel person deep down as a writer. No, you're a lovely person, but as a writer, it is our prerogative to be cruel to our characters. So I guess I kind of wanted to sort of start this whole discussion about sort of enchanting children's books by looking at those kinds of relationships and looking at friendships. Now, I wanted to ask, we've obviously got Sally in there. I always read it as Sal. I always read it as Sal, but it's Sally. There you go.
I always say it's however you read it in your head, because it's really not up to me at the point where it's been printed how you want to read it in your head. And I know somebody, we might have talked about this before, or it might have been one of you that told me that they had a friend who, if they couldn't pronounce the name that they read in a book, they would just give the character a completely different name. You know, some of these names that you have in Lord of the Rings, they were just like, yeah, I just called him Mike.
I did call Dumbledore Bumblebee before finding out that Dumbledore actually means Bumblebee. So there you go. And McGonagall was McDonald's. But anyway. So we've obviously got Sally in there as well, and her grandmother. Are we going to see any more of Colin?
We do. We do see quite a bit of Colin. Not in a kind of... Yeah, that sounded a bit ropey, didn't it? Colin returns, and yes, we get to explore more of his friendship with Ariane Wynne as well. So because I know everybody likes Colin, and Colin, I must say, was completely saved and was really went in an early draft of The Apprentice, which was just a kind of passing, fleeting character. And I sent the first few chapters to a really good friend of mine, who I'd been a bookseller with years and years ago, and she's got exquisite taste when it comes to books, and I was really nervous to let her read it, but I thought she, you know, she's also a nice, honest person who would say this is really not very good, and she didn't, and she said, oh, do we get to see any more of that nice young man Colin in the rest of the book? And at that point we didn't. That was it. He's just there at the beginning and he doesn't reappear at all, and I was like, no, but we could do. So Colin is completely there because of my friend Katie. So yes, he owes his existence to my friend Katie, and he
thank
does
you very much, Katie.
he's back in the second book, and we also do get to see more of Jimma as well, who somebody has referred to her recently as Ariane Wynne's frenemy, which I quite like. You know, Ariane was too nice to kind of make enemies of people, but Jimma, we know, is just a bit of a cow, basically.
Mind your language, James. But yeah, cow works. She is a bit of a cow. We also have Ariane Wynne's friends on the other side, as it were, because she ended up befriending a few spirits.
Yeah.
As well. So again, not going to ask you for spoilers, but I hope that we see her expanding those friendships as well, because I think it'll lead to a very interesting sort of dynamic.
Yes. So there's definitely more moon hair, because everybody
yes.
loves Bob the moon.
Yay!
Yeah,
hashtag
team Bob.
So there's more moon hair and more Esther, who was one of the failings that Ariane Wynne meets and who helps her. And he leaves at the end of the first book, which again is not really a spoiler, but he may or may not make an appearance at some point during the second book. And who knows, there may even be more failings appearing in A Witch Alone as well. So despite it being called A Witch Alone, there's quite a lot of people in it.
But being surrounded by people, if you can't rely on any of them, is like being alone.
Well, there you go. It's strange you should say that.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it. I can't wait to have my copy. Now, were you influenced when it came to the friendships? Because obviously you've said that Katie is why Colin is even alive. And so has actually your friendship with Katie at all, or any friendships that you've read, influenced the kind of group dynamic that you're building now in your world?
Goodness me, that's a very hard question for a Sunday afternoon. yes, I think definitely... I think Sally is like the perfect friend, really. And whilst I don't base none of the characters so far based on people I know, I think in lots of ways Sally is an amalgamation of all of my friends, because she's just, you know, she's exactly the sort of friend we want to have. She's kind of she pushes you to do things that you wouldn't necessarily do for yourself. She strives for you to be the best version of yourself that you possibly can be. And sometimes she's just a little bit too much, which is definitely describes quite a lot of my friends, I think. So definitely the kind of the friendship thing, and friends are so important. I think often they can be more important than our family. And certainly when we're writing books for middle grade, I was having this conversation with some writer friends recently, this idea about, you know, we've somehow got to get the parents out of the way so that the main characters, the children, can go off and have all of these exciting adventures. And whether that's that they're negligent parents or that you rather unkindly bump them off before the story starts or very early in the book, is it, you know, it kind of, it means that the friendships become that become that family to the child or the main character. I think definitely the friendships I have are really influential in that way. And in terms of friends, when you're reading books and people have friends in books, you always think, oh, I wish I had a friend like that person there. So last year I really, really loved Mold and the Poison Plot by Lorraine Gregory, and that's a wonderful book full of really amazing friendships, the sort of friendships that pull your heart out, give it a little polish and put it back in again. It was just it's just a superb book full of lots of different types of friendships and relationships. So kind of semi-adoptive parents and kind of role models, people we admire, and then those kind of friends that that kind of stick with you even when you possibly don't really want to be friends with them. they're sort of true friends, and you kind of think, oh god, they're a bit annoying, but actually I really, really like them. And they just won't go away.
Like siblings.
So that's a really lovely book full of friendship that I've read recently.
It makes me think of, I had the opposite experience when I read Jules's second book.
My second book? Really?
Your second book. Yeah, I Am the Silence, because of course we have the main character, Emmeline, who goes to stay with her best friend, Beth. And I was expecting great adventures with these two friends, because she'd had such a rotten time with her sisters in the first book. But no, I don't consider this to be a spoiler, because Beth is a terrible friend. terrible friend, and I spent the entire book going, I'm a better friend to you, Emmeline. We don't exist in the same realm, but I am a better friend to you.
I remember the colourful messages I got from you now. I can't repeat them, but...
No, but speaking about sort of those sort of family friendships, I recently read Who Let the Gods Out by Maz Evans. You know it.
I know it. I love it. It's a very, very good book.
Yeah, it's very, very humorous, excellent pace. And I quite liked the dynamic between the main character and a female character who comes into it as well. And I guess possibly because I've been reading a lot of YA, I have been sort of inundated with romance, which sort of, I don't mind, but sort of started to get a bit grinding, because I just thought, just let two people be friends, please. Mm. And obviously Virgo is an interesting character. I mean, I can't help the fact I'm also a Virgo.
Me too.
So there you go. Oh, so you're September?
Very end of August.
Okay. So I'm a Virgo, so I felt connected to Virgo as a character. And then of course you have Zeus coming in. And the reason I liked it is because it is a book, well, it's a series, which is about family, but it's also about the kind of the created families, in that the main character, whose name has just flown out of my head.
Elliot.
Thank you. The main character, Elliot, sort of gets adopted by these Greek gods.
Mm.
And there's a mystery of who his father is. And we talked about sort of offing the parents. That was actually our first episode that we ever did together, James. You may not recall, but we talked about sort of drowning parents and offing them, and how we got good parents.
Yeah.
And in this case, Elliot's dad isn't there. We don't know what's happened to him. And Elliot's mum is suffering from dementia.
Mm.
So she's a comforting figure, but she's not responsible for him.
No.
In a lot of ways, which I thought was a really unique and interesting way of dealing with the parent problem in children's books, whilst also kind of giving a unique perspective, because I don't think dementia is seen very often in children's books, not in the serious way. We get forgetful characters, but we don't get that kind of that serious side to it as well. So I really, really like that. But the reason I bring this up is that Elliot and Virgo's friendship is quite unique because he finds her really annoying to begin with.
Yeah.
Which I think it's so true because, of course, he's a 12-year-old boy or something like that. This random girl appears. She goes on like she knows everything. So he just finds her annoying, which I just think is great. And of course, she's hundreds of years old and she just thinks that he's a bit of an idiot. Mm-hmm. And then in the end, even though that they're squabbling, they sort of team up really well together. And they create this nice balance and this kind of interesting friendship.
Yeah, they're a brilliant double act. Very good. And the whole book is just, it's another one, you know, that's kind of the whole thing with Elliot's mum and the dementia and just the you wouldn't expect it to appear in that book. If you read the blurb, if you know Maz, then you're expecting a kind of roller coaster, laugh out loud, laugh a second adventure, and you get it, but you also get this very emotional, very thoughtful, very carefully done reflection on what it means for a child to be in a caring responsibility and dealing with an adult that's unwell and the whole thing around dementia as well, which is just she just does it really, really superbly.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that just because she says I'm a really lovely person.
she did say that you were a really lovely person. We had a moment gushing about you. I met her in Winchester and I said, oh, do you know James? And she was like, oh, James, he's so lovely. And so we just sat and we talked about you for a bit. All nice things.
Good.
But I think you've really kind of pinpointed there the ingredients of a good middle grade book. And that is to have those relationships, to have that humour. And above all, to have that very heartfelt seriousness that comes with children's books, even if it's wrapped up in something lovely.
Yes.
I think of a single children's book which I've personally loved that doesn't have some of that heart-wrenching side to it as well. Mm. Even if that heart-wrenching side is something relatively small, like the loss, not doesn't have to include death or illness or destruction. It can be something small as the loss of a pet or strained relationship with a parent or anything like that. But the dealing with those emotions, I think, is really at the core of every enchanting piece of middle grade fiction, and I think it's especially important when we touch on speculative fiction, because that is the in that lets children of that age really come into the story.
Definitely. And it's it does, I think there are books out there that don't, I won't name any names, but they, when you read them, they feel like something's missing, like there's only one level of story there, like there's no depth to it, you don't feel like you're connecting to the story. And if you don't feel you're doing that as an adult reader, then I can't see that children do either. It's important that children can read whatever they want, of course, and sometimes you do just want to read something very, very light, and you don't want, you're necessarily something to, I'm a strong believer of, books being diverse and children being able to see characters and people with lives that reflect them. Mm. Absolutely, that's completely right. But I'm also a massive believer in children having books that help them escape their lives.
Yeah.
And to project themselves into somebody else and be a different character. That's what books did for me as a child. I didn't want to read books about children that were living a life like mine, because I was living that life and I didn't want to be reading about it as well. I wanted to be off having adventures with, you know, Susan and Lucy and Edmund and Peter in Narnia, and I didn't want to be stuck in the 1980s growing up doing what I was doing at that time. So yeah, I think it needs, middle grade and YA needs to encompass all of those different things so that children get the best possible opportunity to read far and wide.
Yeah, definitely. And as you were talking about growing up in the 1980s, it's nice to have someone else on the show who did. I will say, normally I'm just stuck with Madeline. But there was a time period there.
Are you saying that she was already grown up by the 1980s?
No, she wasn't even thought of. I don't
know. I wasn't thought
conceived of her at that point. But yeah, there was a time period, weirdly, in the 1980s where it was sort of frowned on to have too much fantasy in children's books. There was a weird sort of 10-year period there. And I know Diana Wynne Jones spoke about it in her book of essays, Reflection, saying she had books she wrote in that period she couldn't get published because they had too much fantasy in. And there was this received wisdom that you were actually damaging a child's ability to perceive reality by giving them too much fantasy.
Yep, absolutely.
Just bonkers.
And now... James, I'm going to ask you, have you read A Girl of Ink and Stars?
I have, yes.
Now, before I sort of dive into it, because I want to discuss it a little bit, what was your impression?
I really, really fell in love with it. It's so beautifully written. It's like reading a dream. I think that's the best way to describe it. I used to keep a dream journal years ago, and I found it recently, and I was reading through it, and I didn't sort of separate things out, so you just kind of read through. And I also did it for last year or the year before for a writing workshop thing that I went on. We were encouraged to keep a dream journal for a couple of weeks beforehand, and I did the same thing now. I just kind of wrote them straight after one another. I didn't keep a date of, you know, when I had the dream. And I think that's what Girl of Ink and Stars, thinking back to when I read it, because it's now, when did it come out? 2016, same year as The Apprentice, which I read it, you know, almost as soon as it came out, because I'd met Kieran on some Chicken House bits and pieces, and I'd heard her read it. We went on some author training together. That was the first day we met, and we had to read, we had to do a reading to everybody that day, and she read it out, and it was just, I just thought it's just the most beautifully written book. And so I was desperate to read it when it was published. And I really loved it. But I think I loved The Island at the End of Everything even more.
Oh, okay. That's
possible.
Is that a sequel or is it just a...
No, it's a completely standalone story.
Okay.
And quite a different story, despite the fact there's an island. It's not got the fantasy element that's there in Girl of Ink and Stars, but it's still very mysterious and kind of mystical, I suppose. But yes, I really did enjoy Girl of Ink and Stars, and I think, you know, it's had a lot of attention, and I think rightly so, because what she's offering in the likes of, you know, along the lines of people like Catherine Rundell is some really brilliantly written books for middle grade, which, you know, rather than just how to phrase it, really, without offending, but it's just that, you know, that she's a master of her craft.
It feels like literary fiction, doesn't it?
Definitely. Yeah. And I think
it feels like middle grade literary fiction, I think, is the best way to sort of...
Is just the beginning, I think, you know, and Kieran's sickeningly young and talented. Where will she be in sort of 10 years' time? I can only imagine what she'll be giving us to feast our eyes on then.
See, I'm glad that you said you liked it because actually I didn't get on with it.
Okay.
But I know that that's a very personal thing for me. And I much prefer it when if I don't like something, I'm there, I can discuss it with someone who did, because I think that if you hear from one person's point of view, I want our listeners to sort of understand what kind of they might be looking at. And I do recommend it
Sure.
as a book. But I didn't like it because even though it possessed all of the qualities that I usually love, so a little bit of I loved the mysticism, and it can't be denied the writing is poetic and absolutely beautiful. It was definitely my favorite part of the book. The prose just flowed in a fantastic melodic way. I can't deny the craft that went into that. And I agree with you. I think it did feel very dreamlike. The thing I didn't get along with, however, was that you started to get a base of these friendships, but I never really felt like I had any reason to really care about any of the characters.
Right.
I didn't connect with the main character in the same way that I connected with Ariane Wynne, or in the same way that I connected with Harry from Harry Potter. I don't know why I didn't connect with her. And I think possibly actually the reason that it really maybe jarred me was that you had the loss of this main character's twin brother and her mother. This was introduced to us very, very early on. And whilst on the one side I say, you know, it's a very realistic thing because it's just something that happened and it's something she just has to live with, it never ever really came into her development as a character or into the plot itself, which kind of left me at the end of the book sort of aching a little bit. Because for me, a children's book should present a problem. It should present these complicated feelings. And then at the end, they don't need to necessarily be solved, but there needs to be this sense of completion. Because I think if you leave a children's book feeling desperately sad without any of that kind of, but everything is going to be all right, I don't really feel that that's successful. So, I mean, even in Private Peaceful, when you have a very, very sad ending, there was still that sense of peace as well. And at the end of A Girl of Ink and Stars, and once again, this is very personal to me. I got to the end, and I don't want to spoil it for anyone who wants to read it, but there was a lot of death. And the character felt less toward the end, like she'd lost a huge chunk of herself and hadn't really gained anything in the process. She was just reduced. And it might have been because I was feeling particularly depressed at the time, but I just finished the book and went, great, I just feel worse. There was no kind of sense of journey or completion. It just got progressively worse and then ended. But you don't feel this way, James.
No, but I feel like I want to go back and reread it now, and kind of, I suppose when I was reading it, it's interesting, like you were saying, you know, with the mood that you take to a story, because I'm a massive believer in the fact that, you know, the book is only really half written by the author. The reader completes the story completely. You know, that book, any book is nothing until somebody reads it. And you know, you can do all sorts of stuff. You can edit it to within an inch of its life, but you know, that's probably not a good idea. But it's worth nothing until somebody reads it and brings their perspective, their ideas, their hopes, their dreams, their everything to that story. And they sort of fill in the blank bits as well, because I think writing, it's a bit like doing a pointillist painting, isn't it? You know, you don't really see it yourself because you're so close to the dots. But when somebody stands back and looks at it, it's their kind of, you know, it's what happens in their brain that brings the story and the picture together. And so we all see things slightly differently, and that really depends on where we are at the time when we read a book. I'm gonna have to go back and reread it, I think.
It's very Roland Barthes of you. I feel like Roland Barthes, death of the author, is he's raising his head in victory. Sorry, I have an almost constant battle going on with Roland Barthes because I don't know whether I agree with him or I absolutely loathe him. The author in me loathes him because I hate the idea of being killed off, but the reader in me kind of goes, yeah. So that is a very interesting perspective, and I completely agree that the other part of a children's text, which makes it so successful, is the reader and the child who reads it, basically, because they are the ones who are going to truly bring it to life. And I do genuinely believe that, for instance, Who Let the Gods Out, a book I really, really did enjoy. I know that if I'd read it when I was the target reader, I would have enjoyed it even more.
Mm.
Just because it captures the imagination and the pace that one needs for that sort of that level of readership, which is not, again, this is not me saying, well, they don't read quite as well because they're younger. That's not it at all. It's about understanding the emotions and the experiences of people in that age. So I'm completely with you on this, James.
I think, yeah. To dismiss a child for not understanding the world is very short-sighted, and the sort of thing that characters in books do quite a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know any children's authors that would ever do that, because I think we have a unique perspective, whether that's through just, you know, meeting so many children, or because we obviously... There must be something in the being able to write for a child that you're still there as a child as well. I don't know. I don't really understand it. It's like magic.
I think that we're in touch with our inner child in some ways. That children's fiction writers are still connected with that inner child.
Yeah, and you know, we were talking about Diana Wynne Jones and her essays, which are just, you know, they're like the everything to me. I love that book so much, and she's just brilliant. And she says on more than one occasion in those essays and other pieces I've read she's written about this idea that, you know, not underestimating that a child will understand what an adult won't when they read a book, and not kind of having to explain everything, because, you know, that's what our imaginations are for, is to fill in the gaps. So I think, you know, underestimate the child's emotional maturity at your peril, I think.
Yeah, that's something I found weirdly doing story time at the library, and you get a variety of age groups, and sometimes the parents listen to me as well. It's really weird. But they'll sort of think they can shove the children at me, I'll read the story, and they get half an hour to chat. And weirdly enough, the parents start listening as well. And some of them at the end will say, that's a very strange book. And one was saying that about, have you ever read the Mr. Gunn books? They're really sort of younger junior fiction, so not really mid-grade. But they're very, very clever, and they're very funny. But they're probably incomprehensible to adults if you can't see them through a child's perspective. And one parent was saying that it's a very peculiar book, but they're obviously enjoying it. I just don't understand why. And this little boy pipes up and just basically summarizes the entire plot for the adult at 8 years old.
Brilliant. The Mr. Gunn books, I know they're massively popular with children in the libraries where I work as well. So, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I feel that actually there's a wisdom and there is an intelligence required to read children's books that we sometimes don't get in adult books. And that's, it comes with that sense of wonder. But I think it's because of the way that children process information differently to the way that adults do, because they're in a phase of their life where they're sponges and they're learning, which means that when they're given information, they of course they process it differently to adults who are kind of just adding things to a pile, as it were. And I will definitely get, I'm usually more emotionally invested, more likely to cry, more likely to really feel and see absolute depth in a children's book than I am in a book set for adults. Mm. And I also think that's because there's a different kind of consideration that goes to, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, James, but there's a different kind of consideration that goes into writing for children than goes into writing for adults, because you have to put yourself in a mindset which allows a generation of people who are still optimistic to sort of to insert themselves into it.
Mm. Yeah, and I think, you know, I, not that I've ever really written for adults, not that I've consciously tried. So I don't know exactly, but I think that again is often where the input from your publisher and your editor is really crucial, because they have that so in the forefront of their minds. You know, they are always thinking about the reader and what, you know, what it's going to be like for the reader when they've got your book in their hands. And so what they add to that part of the process is the kind of the magic ingredient, I think. Hopefully, you know, hopefully you're doing a lot of that work yourself. If not, you probably need to be rethinking what you're doing. But I think, you know, they do just bring something extra to it to kind of help you, you know, hone it. And I think, you know, that's part of what happened with A Witch Alone, really. We went through, you know, different drafts and slightly different things happening in the plot. And it was always coming back to, well, what, you know, what are the readers who have loved, hopefully, The Apprentice Witch, what are they going to want to see happen? What are they going to be surprised at having happen in a second book? And always trying to think about them with every kind of tap of the keyboard or whatever you do. So you do have them more in your mind as you go along, I think, whereas probably when I just started writing The Apprentice Witch, I was just writing a book, I was just writing a story. Whereas now, you know, I think about some of the children I've met over the last sort of 2 years and think, oh, you know, will they enjoy the second book? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, the pressure.
I've got a slightly different question for both of you, actually, because I was just thinking, I had quite eclectic taste in books as a child, as I still do now, but have either of you gone back and read a book you loved as a child to find that it's a completely different book to what you remembered, as in what you took out of it as a child with something you can't get as an adult? And I'll give you an example. One of my favourite books when I was 9 was Moonfleet by J.M. Faulkner, which I know is a weird book to have as a favourite when you like. But I loved the main character in that. I thought John was brilliant. He was adventurous. He was solving this great mystery about where the diamond was. And I reread it a couple of years ago, and all the way through I was going, what a crap. The main character is not the main character I remember. He's reckless. He's rude. He's not really that clever. He does stupid things that get him into terrible trouble, that get his, you know, new adopted father into trouble. And the guy Elsevier, who sort of adopts him, actually didn't seem as gruff and terrifying anymore. So it's like my perspective on the whole thing had completely shifted, even though I remembered how that book made me feel as a child. So have you ever experienced that?
Yes. It's also been with things that I've watched as well.
Yeah.
It's that joke that you always see where, you know, when you're little and Ariel's saying, but I love him, father, and you're like, yeah, come on, Neptune, she's 15 or 16, I can't remember, she's 16 years old, she's old enough to fall in love and make her own decisions. And now I'm watching, I'm like, go back to school, Ariel, what are you doing? it's the moment when you think when you're growing up you're going to be one character, and then you turn out to be the the stern parental figure instead. And I'm only 25, but I feel that very keenly. I definitely have experienced things where characters who I've associated so strongly with, who I've really liked, I look back on now with perspective, and also considering the fact that these are going to be things which are going to be dated by the time that they were written and released. You know, I look back now and I go, well, that's sexist. Well, that's gross. Well, that's a bit rapey, to be honest. and sort of I see things from a different perspective. So I think, yeah, sometimes children's books, the beloved books of our childhood should be left in our childhood.
We're moving house, so we're packing things up at the moment. And so I'm constantly not packing boxes and reading books.
Naturally.
And I was looking over, it wasn't the my most beloved book from childhood is The 101 Dalmatians. And I think I have reread that in the last sort of 5 years. But there's not many people know this. There is a sequel to The 101 Dalmatians.
Yeah, The Twilight Barking.
Yes.
Which is mental.
Which is. It is. It's like Jodie Smith on acid.
Yes.
With severe concussion. possibly post-traumatic stress disorder. I don't know. But it is just the most bonkers book. And I remember it being a bonkers book, but thinking, oh, it's quite fun. And I did read that about five or six years ago. I think I found it in a jumble sale. I thought, oh, I must read. Must read this again just to see whether it really was as bonkers as I remembered it being. And I think it wasn't a very good book at all, actually. I was it bonkers, but it really wasn't a very good book. But I do know some people that absolutely love it and love it more than 101 Dalmatians, which is, you know, why I don't speak to those people anymore, because they're far.
James, you're lethal.
I'm joking. I do to them if I'm forced to. That's like a really, that was a shock to kind of go back and do that. And I guess as well, some of the Narnia books,
yeah,
which when you go back and reread them as an adult, you're kind of like, ooh.
Well, yeah,
poor Susan, yes, wanting to put that lipstick on.
Exactly, left behind because she wanted to grow up. Yeah.
Yeah.
No heaven for her. Sorry.
Let's just preserve it in the lovely cocoon of our childhood memory.
Yeah.
And just go, here, read this, young child. It's wonderful. And they're probably thinking, what's wrong with you?
I think, yeah. I also find there are some children's books, I'm thinking of The Wind in the Willows, that I actually love more as an adult.
I only read that as an adult, so I don't have a childhood memory of that book.
It's one of the few books my mum actually read to us, because I took over the reading of the books to my younger siblings quite early on. But she read that one, and I remember my sister being really bored in a chapter called Piper at the Gates of Dawn, where it goes all weird neo-pagan and you've got Pan the Piper there. But I remember liking it as a child, and I got even more out of it as an adult.
Yeah.
Now, we're nearing the end of the episode, but before we sort of go, I'm going to do a few, I say quick fire. I'm just going to ask you a few questions, James.
Ooh.
Yes.
This is my specialist subject.
I'm going to ask you a few questions. Is your specialist subject is you.
Oh, I'd be hopeless at that one.
I hope it's your specialist subject. I mean... Maybe you want to call your partner in. I don't know. You can phone a friend. Ask your dog. I'm sure. Bonnie, is it Bonnie the dog?
It is Bonnie. She's asleep somewhere warm. She's not in here with me.
Okay. So I guess the first question I want to ask you is, do you think you'll write any other series after or at the same time as The Apprentice Witch?
Yes, I do. Do you just want one-word answers?
Well, okay.
I've had an idea for a story almost as well. It's something that cropped up when I was doing the Golden Egg workshops, and I've kind of been doing bits and pieces, you know, squirreling ideas and things away for this story, so I'd really love to to do something with that at some point, whether that's alongside or after or midway between the apprentice, which we'll see. At the moment, the plan is that there will be a third apprentice, which book, which I'm writing at the moment, which I'm very much enjoying. And it's all kind of wintry, just to give you a little spoiler. But yeah, we'll have to wait and see. I might spin off into writing, you know, hard crime novels for adults.
That was my next question, is do you think you're going to stick with middle grade, or are you going to sort of maybe dip your toe into YA or adult?
I think I would stick with middle grade, because there's it just feels, the whole thing just feels magical. I think I'm very lucky to get to do this, so I think I would want to carry on if I can.
If you could go back in time and say just one piece of advice to pre-published, pre-discovered James Nicol, who was maybe even just starting to put the apprentice switch together, what would you say?
Well, I'd probably tell myself not to panic and that you're not having a stroke, because I think if I suddenly appeared in front of myself, that might be the best thought going on. And then I don't know. I think I don't know if I'd want to know anything, because who knows, if I knew something, it might all turn out very differently. You know, I watched Quantum Leap as a teenager, and I know how it can change the whole thing. I think just get on and write the story that you want to write. Don't, because I did start off with something else, but only for about, 3 days. And it was just like, why are you even bothering to write that story when you know deep down in your heart it's a story that's got magic in it, that's for middle grade readers that you really, really, really want to be writing. Write the story you want to write and would have wanted to have read as a child. I think that's the best start.
All right. What would you have called Ariane Wynne if she had been a boy?
Oh my goodness me, that's a really difficult question. I would have called her, I think she would have been called Oliver. I think they would have named her after her father, who is called Oliver.
Okay, all right.
Spoiler for book 3, he may be appearing.
Ooh. Is there going to be any romance at all in the background or anything like that?
In my life, or in the book?
In your life, yes. You might want to phone your partner for that one.
Yeah,
phone
a friend. I'll see what romance is on the cards. Barry Cunningham's already told me that I'm not allowed any kissing. And I think he was talking about the books.
But you're just to be sure.
I think it might. Who knows? I think everybody feels so strongly about Ariane Wynne and Colin, and they can see a glimmer of something there. So it's probably just how I cunningly hide it in the story if it goes any further. But they're only 15, 16. They're not exactly going to be getting married or anything like that.
That's what I like to hear. If you could pick any adult novel and actually have it sort of reworked as a children's book, what would you do?
Oh, that's a very good question. I would pick something like Rebecca is my favorite adult book. That might be an interesting one. Or actually, do you know what? The Miniaturist, because we just watched that at Christmas, and I was telling my partner, you've got to read the book because the book is so amazingly brilliant. And I think that would make an interesting children's book. Miniaturist, there we go.
Excellent. Finally, if you could put yourself into the world of Ariane Wynne, what would you be? Who would you be? What would you be doing?
Oh, well, I'd quite like to think that I would be a witch. And I think I would probably be a witch in a quite a little coastal town somewhere where they get plagued by sea creatures on a regular basis, but it's not too taxing.
would you live beside the bookshop?
No, oh no, no, I wouldn't. No, I don't. No, I wouldn't want to live in the city. No, I'd want to be by the seaside somewhere.
Yeah, but is it have a little bookshop, a little seaside bookshop?
Oh, like a, yeah, maybe. Yeah,
yeah, but
maybe.
The little local one.
I think you went, that's where you want to live.
I think that's where Jules would be working.
Quite probably, yeah.
All right. Well, this has been fantastic. I do have one more question for you, James. One more. Will we be able to grab you again sometime in the future to come back onto the show?
Of course you can. I love to be back on. Do you know what? I must just tell you this. I always get my podcasts always automatically download when they're available. And the other day I was going somewhere and all of a sudden this music started up in my pocket and I was like, whatever is it? And it just suddenly started playing Dissecting Dragons for no apparent reason in my pocket. And I was like, oh my goodness. And everybody was like looking at me really strangely as I was fumbling to unlock the phone and stop it so that it didn't suddenly start playing. Not that I'm ashamed, but it was just a bit, you know, in the middle of Tesco's doing your shopping to have the Dissecting Dragons theme tune blaring out of your pocket. It was a little uncomfortable. But yes, no, I would love to come back anytime you'll have me, because it's always good fun to chat with you both.
Oh, yeah, well, brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on to the show, James. It's been an absolute pleasure. We will hold you to that. We've got it in recording now. So yeah. When you're too much of a big shot, we'll say, actually, I think you're fine. So to all of our listeners, if you haven't read The Apprentice Witch yet, go out and get it right now and gobble it up before March, when A Witch Alone will be coming out. And if you have read The Apprentice Witch and you want a little bit of a taste of James's work, you can find the first chapter on the Chicken House website and we will include a link for you. So thanks very much for listening and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye, and thanks very much, James.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.